Some positive economic indicators are coming out of Europe. Welcome news, but too early to call it a trend.
It will depend on a number of factors, some of which are also geopolitical nature, and we do not know much because we live in a rather uncertain world.
Also today on the show, Iraq's date palm trees under threat, first from decades of war and now from climate change. Efforts are being taken to reverse the trend.
They are finding different grassroots tactics to keep their trees alive and also to keep the date economy alive and maybe even grow it back.
I'm Marco Werman, and swimming the sea for more than 2 days straight, pushing the envelope of what's humanly possible.
I was pretty exhausted. The last few miles have been pretty horrific.
Jellyfish in your face and much more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Thanks for making it here. We start the program today in Ukraine. Day after day, week after week, the headlines of bombings and drone strikes begin to blur together. The war has become a stalemate. This spring, the conflict was supposed to enter a new phase, with Ukrainian troops launching a major push to retake territory Russia seized, but the long-anticipated spring offensive seems to have been delayed. Ukrainian journalist Volodymyr Solohub is in eastern Ukraine this week, not far from the front lines. He joins us from the Donetsk region. Volodymyr, where have you been in recent days, and what have you been seeing?
In the past 2 weeks, we've visited a number of frontline positions with the Ukrainian army. We've been with the artillery unit, with the drone unit, and we're seeing fighting. We're seeing heavy fighting in some areas. Whenever we get really close to the front line, we hear constant bangs. We hear constant sound of artillery fighting back and forth, because here in eastern Ukraine, it's more about the artillery fighting on both sides. And unfortunately, we're hearing the sound of drones, and you can never tell if it's Ukrainian or Russian drone above us. It's always advisable to leave the area as soon as you hear the drone flying above you.
So we're going to hear some audio that you recorded. It made me wonder what it's like day to day for the soldiers who set off barrages like these aimed at Russian troops. I mean, seriously heavy hardware there, and one wonders what the return strikes might be from the Russian side. How are these Ukrainian soldiers holding up? What is morale like?
Well, Marco, the morale is actually pretty high. Of course, everybody is anticipating the long-expected counteroffensive. Most likely, this will be a summer counteroffensive. And obviously, as a journalist, we're asking the soldiers, so what are you hearing? Are you preparing? What one of the artillery unit commanders said is, listen, we're killing them in defensive, and we'll be killing them in offensive as well. So obviously, Marco, as you hear, the morale for these soldiers is pretty high.
So now this long-awaited spring offensive, Volodymyr, may be morphing into a summer offensive. Describe the energy and intensity close to the front line at this moment.
Marco, the fighting here in eastern Ukraine is on and off. There are hotspots such as Bakhmut, a city that Russians were trying to seize for almost 8 months. A few weeks ago, they finally announced that they've retaken control over the entire city. Also, the town of Avdiivka has seen a very heavy fighting. It really depends on where in the front line you're positioned, you're located, Marco.
The hardware from the West continues to be approved by lawmakers throughout NATO countries. Did you see new Western and U.S.-made weaponry and vehicles? Were they visible?
Absolutely, Marco. We were lucky enough to see the ever-elusive HIMARS system that has been provided to the Ukrainians by the United States. Ukrainian army is guarding this crown jewel, if you will, of the artillery systems. They're not allowing journalists to film, or they're not disclosing any locations of the HIMARS. So we saw the HIMARS passing us on the roads while we were driving, and we were lucky enough to snap a few photographs. What we were able to observe was the operation of the artillery system Caesar, which has been provided by France, and the operation of a brand new Vampire MLRS, which was provided by the Czech Republic, which actually you heard earlier in the program.
Right. Well, on top of the high-tech weapon systems from the West, you also saw Ukrainian soldiers launching some small drones. In this video you recorded, it looks like they've tied an enormous elastic rubber band onto the ground and pulled it back to launch the drone. I mean, it's really low tech, but it seems to move, right?
Yes, Marco, it's low tech, but the soldiers say it's high inefficiency. And it's almost like do-it-yourself launching system for this drone. It's a Ukrainian-made drone. The company started producing it since the beginning of this full-scale invasion in 2022. And the unit that operates it says that out of all the commercial drones that are available on the market, this is preferred for some of the reconnaissance operations because it can fly out in the distance of up to 25 miles.
Wow. So it's kind of a mix of low-tech DIY weapons and high-tech weaponry. What about the soldiers fighting in this volatile part of Ukraine? Are they experienced troops or a mix of new recruits and veteran fighters?
A lot of the soldiers we've spoken to are these real hardcore veterans that joined the army prior to the full-scale invasion in 2022. They've spent years here in the East. They know all of the ins and outs of this region. But obviously, we also met some of the soldiers that are fresh recruits that have gone through 7 months of training and were sent to Bakhmut, for example, and then spent their 7 months repelling the Russian offensive in that city.
So as you said, the city of Bakhmut is nearby. The battle there lasted many months, and it fell to Russian troops about 10 days ago, thanks in large part to Russian Wagner Group mercenaries and their fighters recruited from prisons in Russia. Have they completely pulled out of Bakhmut now and left the town to regular Russian troops?
Marco, this is something which is very difficult to independently verify. What I can tell, Marco, is that when talking to Ukrainian soldiers and asking them if they've seen any evidence that the Wagner Group have retreated, what they tell me is that they do see these signs because they say when they're fighting the Wagner Groups, they are not retreating at all. They're standing their positions. They're sending more and more troops for slaughter, whereas the Russian regular troops are using a better military tactic, and when necessary, they are retreating, Marco.
Volodymyr, you also spoke with civilians still hunkered down in their hometown, struggling in really difficult conditions, in some cases without any running water. Is any clean water available in these areas? What did you see?
Yes, a few days ago, we joined a firefighter's crew in that town of Konstantinivka, which is some 10 miles from the front line. And they are delivering water to civilians on a daily basis because the pumping station for part of the town was cut off from the electricity because of the fighting. And therefore, these residents, they don't have running water. And that's why the firefighters, they're delivering it. The civilians are heavily reliant on that. And they're obviously very grateful for the firefighters.
Meanwhile, Volodymyr, in the capital Kyiv, aerial assaults have been relentless throughout the month of May. You're speaking with us from eastern Ukraine, but you live in Kyiv. What has it been like in Kyiv, Volodymyr?
Marco, I can tell you that I'm currently some 40 miles from the front line, and the last 2 weeks that I've been here have been much quieter than the last 2 weeks in Kyiv.
Really?
I know that my friends, they have to go into the bomb shelters again on a daily basis. Some people sleep in the subway stations underground. They stay there overnight because they're concerned for their safety.
At the same time, residents in Kyiv no doubt saw the videos of drones exploding over residential areas of Moscow early Tuesday morning. What's the range of responses you've heard from Ukrainians?
Marco, I can tell you that it's not a range of responses. The response is very clear and across the line from everyone. People say that finally people who live in Moscow can go through the same experiences that millions of Ukrainians have been going through for the last year and a half, Marco.
We'll leave it there. Ukrainian journalist Volodymyr Solohub is in eastern Ukraine in the Donetsk region. He's been speaking with us about his recent travels near frontline positions there. Thank you very much, Volodymyr. Good to speak with you. Stay safe.
Thank you, Marco.
When voters in Turkey chose to stay the course with President Recep Tayyip Erdogan, it also meant likely staying the course with Erdogan's unconventional economic policies, primarily keeping interest rates low despite inflation. Economists say that play was responsible for weakening the Turkish lira. The currency is now worth less than a third of what it was 3 years ago compared to the U.S. dollar. As a result, an underground foreign exchange market in Istanbul is thriving. The world's Duri Biskaran spoke with vendors there.
The lira is sliding again, and when the market is in flux, this alleyway gets crazy. Every second is money for these guys, says broker Fatih Kaya. I'm deep in the heart of Istanbul's Grand Bazaar, a 500-year-old warren of shops and craftsmen selling anything you can think of. But in this alley, traders gather in person to buy and sell foreign currencies. They call it the Ayakla Bursa, the stock market on foot.
Merkez Bankası'nı referans alır. Burası sadece serbest piyasa.
Banks in Turkey follow the central bank to set their exchange rates, Kaya says. But here, the exchange rate is set by the free market, supply and demand. In the crowd, a trader yells out that he has $100,000 to sell.
Şimdi buranın bir jargonu var, bir dili var. Şu anda bir başka müşteriye.
Kaya explains that the trader calls out how much he can sell it for, and a customer will approach him to negotiate a price. They'll seal the deal with a verbal agreement. That's another thing. Everyday people can't make deals here. These traders represent companies or exchange offices doing wholesale transactions of foreign currencies. There's even a code. Dollars are called tam, or full. Euros were called softies for a while, and an old name for the Saudi rial was a haji, an honorific for a person who has made the pilgrimage to Mecca.
Burada tamamen dürüstlük üzerine kuruludur sistem.
The system is set up entirely on honesty, Kaya says. Anyone who makes a bad deal gets blacklisted permanently. As we speak, Kaya pauses for a moment and turns his head.
Bakın, iki salise önce fiyat değişti.
The price changed a couple seconds ago, he says. He can tell by the sound. With a short goodbye, he disappears into the crowd. Dollars are important in Turkey. Because inflation rates are so high, a lot of Turkish households keep their savings in foreign currencies, or even gold. Companies that import goods for Turkish consumers often do business in dollars. But dollars are harder to find these days, as the country's central bank tries to protect the value of the Turkish lira. Timothy Ash is a financial analyst with Blue Bay Asset Management in London. He says Turkey does this by limiting access to dollars through regulations and taxes on currency conversions.
There's a lot of pressure being exerted by the Erdogan administration to kind of try and hold the currency and not raise rates.
In most cases, economists suggest that governments raise interest rates when inflation is high. Erdogan has done the opposite. In the run-up to the elections, Ash says, the government was able to prop up the value of the Turkish lira temporarily, but saw its net reserves fall below zero for the first time in 21 years.
Too much demand for dollars, too little demand for lira. The economy's been running too hot in the run-up to elections, too much growth. The options for Erdogan are kind of running out now.
Deron Acemoğlu, an economist at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, says the Erdogan administration has two options: let the currency drop now, or use money from abroad to manage the decline.
It may well be that they decide, okay, fine, the election is over, let's have the pain once and for all and do a big devaluation now. Or they may decide, let's stick to what we have right now for a while longer.
This could mean Erdogan will get closer to his allies in the Gulf or even Russia as he searches for cash. But, Acemoğlu says, the overall health of the Turkish economy doesn't look great. Economic growth is relying heavily on construction and government spending, not improving the efficiency of production or the quality of exports.
This is a basic structural issue that Turkey has to grapple with and hasn't really grappled with.
For everyday spenders in Turkey, Acemoğlu says, that means tough times could be ahead. For The World, I'm Derry Buscarin in Istanbul.
I'm Marco Werman. It's The World. In Europe, happy days are here again. Okay, so I'm overselling the story just a bit. Inflation is moderating, though, and unemployment is falling. European regulators are breathing a big sigh of relief that Washington did not burn down the world economy. That was the worst-case fear if Washington was unable to reach a deal on raising the debt ceiling and not defaulting on America's IOUs. Add it all up, the European stock market seemed pretty happy today. Here to make sense of all of this is Cinzia Alcidi, the director of research at the Center for European Policy Studies in Brussels. This question is always a speculative one, Cinzia, but let me ask it anyway. What are European markets reacting to today?
I think that there are several news which are defining the reaction of financial markets. For sure, the fact that US is not defaulting, even though I have to say that I would guess that the financial markets were not putting high odds on the default of the United States. Since 1960, the US debt ceiling has been increased 78 times and about 20 times since 2000. So I think many were expecting the debt ceiling to be increased once again.
Yeah, so you kind of look at that as the key moment here, the key event.
I think so. But I think there is more going on. In particular, the news about inflation in the euro area seems quite good. So basically, inflation has been declining now for 5 months. And core inflation, because basically the need for further interest rate hikes becomes lower. So there may be further interest rates increase, but maybe at a lower pace. And maybe we are moving towards a more stable environment.
How do the policies and interest rate hikes in Europe compare with the US, as long as we're talking inflation?
Europe is always lagging behind the US. So inflation appeared in the US earlier than in Europe. Interest rate hikes started in the US before in the euro area. So now that the Fed has given some signal of taking a break with the interest rate hikes, I think in Europe we may see some further increase, but we are probably moving in the same direction. So at least this is expectation at the moment. But I think we have some good reasons to believe that prices will be stabilizing.
Yeah, what about sectors where inflation you see still kind of high and rising in Europe?
I think this is a very important point, because if we look at the different sectors of the economy, the two main drivers of inflation is basically food and beverages and hotels and restaurants. So it really looks like the food component is the main responsible basically for inflation. And this is something that somehow it's not obvious to understand why inflation is so persistent there. One explanation is, of course, energy prices. So energy is always a very important input in the production of food. For instance, fertilizers, which are key for agriculture production, and transport is usually very important for the distribution of food.
But if we're talking food and food systems and restaurants, I mean, when do you think actual real people are going to feel the benefit of what we're seeing today at an industrial level?
Yeah, this is actually the big question, which is actually quite difficult to answer. Many are speaking about some companies in some sectors actually just taking advantage of their ability to set prices. So we don't know to what extent this is the case, but in principle, these margins should now start to decline. So in the next months, hopefully, we will see some changes in price, which will be tangible for people.
Again, Cinzia, another question that may not be answerable right now, but I have to ask, do you think this kind of stability today is sustainable over the long run?
It will depend on a number of factors, some of which are also geopolitical nature, and we do not know much because we live in a rather uncertain world where basically the position of the United States and China have hardened a lot and investors tend to be much more cautious than in the past when they decided where to invest and when to invest. And this is all across the world, not least in Europe.
I've been speaking with Cinzia Alcidi on a relatively bullish day for European markets. She is the director of research at the Center for European Policy Studies in Brussels. Cinzia, thank you very much for your insight.
Thank you for having me.
India's top wrestlers are making headlines this week, and not for their moves on the mat. Athletes are calling for the arrest and resignation of the head of the Wrestling Federation of India, that is the national governing body for the sport. Protesters say Brijbhushan Sharan Singh sexually harassed a number of women starting in 2012. Singh denies the allegations, but the wrestlers are not backing down. The World's Bianca Hillier reports.
The wrestlers' protest began in January, but they called it off after authorities promised to investigate their complaints. Months went by. Nothing happened. So the athletes went back on the streets in April, demanding action against Singh for the alleged sexual harassment.
So there are a total of 7 complaints, including one complaint that has come in from a minor. So that's child sexual abuse, right?
Arshia Kocher lives in New Delhi, where the protests have been taking place. She's a senior program manager at One Future Collective, a social justice organization in India. One of the wrestlers leading the charge against Singh is Sakshi Malik, who first garnered national attention in 2016. She represented India at the Summer Olympics in Rio de Janeiro.
Sakshi Malik has just taken the bronze medal in the last seconds of the bout.
Malik became the first woman from India to win an Olympic medal in wrestling. At the time, Prime Minister Narendra Modi was quick to congratulate her. He called Malik India's daughter and said she brought a new strength to the country's flag. But Modi's support was nowhere to be found this past weekend, when tension between athletes and authorities came to a head. Video shows police violently pulling athletes in every direction by their limbs and dragging them on the ground. Kocher calls the scenes heartbreaking. She says protesters were apprehended while marching toward the country's brand new parliament building. Modi was there inaugurating the building, and so was Singh, the man wrestlers are accusing of sexual harassment. Singh is also a longtime lawmaker representing Modi's party. Kocher says the weekend's events have resulted in a split in public opinion on the protests.
Some people are, of course, arguing why did they have to protest on this day when it was such a big day for the country. And then there are others also who are trying to mobilize support on the ground.
After being released, the wrestlers said their Olympic medals, which they worked so hard for, no longer meant anything to them. They showed up to the sacred Ganges River on Tuesday to throw them in the water. Before the protesters made the symbolic toss, though, anointed elders and village council leaders approached them. They reportedly persuaded the wrestlers not to throw their medals into the river and to give the government until Sunday to take action against Singh. The wrestlers agreed. While India's National Wrestling Federation did not reply to my request for comment, Singh continues to deny all allegations. He told a crowd yesterday, quote, "If a single allegation against me is proven, I will hang myself. If you have any evidence, present it to the court and I am ready to accept any punishment." The International Olympic Committee has condemned the treatment of the athletes. So has United World Wrestling, the sport's international governing body. They've given India's Wrestling Federation a 45-day deadline to replace Singh or risk being banned from international competition. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
The Delta Blues from Mississippi don't always stay there. For Russian musician Sergei Gringo, the first time he heard the blues, it changed his life forever.
I said to myself, "Hi, Sergei, maybe blues, it's not only the music, maybe it's something more."
Also, the folks who geolocate the fighting in Sudan and fill in the blanks of missing information, still ahead on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. For thousands of years, the palm trees of Iraq have lined the streets and poked above the walls around private homes. But decades of war, urbanization, and now the impact of climate change have decimated many of those date palms. That is the subject of today's Climate Solutions segment, The Big Fix.
Change is coming.
Can we turn this around?
We have no other option.
What we do now will profoundly affect the next few thousand years.
The date palm is a symbol of Iraq and of Baghdad, a symbol that's becoming increasingly scarce. But as the world's Shirin Jafari reports from Baghdad, all is not lost.
Standing at the edge of his farm, Ayad Muhammad Ali points to one of a dozen new construction sites nearby. It's really painful to see this, he says. In Iraq, we don't like to build vertically, and now you see all these lands being turned into buildings. Muhammad Ali has planted date palm trees and vegetables here for the past 3 decades. This green bit of land is his sanctuary. I come here to escape the noise of the city, he says, in his traditional Iraqi outfit called the thob. In the early 1980s, Iraq had an estimated 30 million palm trees. It used to be among the top producers of dates in the world. But war, construction, and the impact of climate change have taken a toll. By 2009, there were less than 9 million date palms left in the country.
This is the hair of the Iraqi desert, right? And we're watching the Iraqi landscape go bald with the stresses of war.
Kali Rubai teaches anthropology at Purdue University. She studied the environmental impact of war in Iraq. She's interviewed date farmers displaced after the U.S. invasion.
Date farming and the lack of date farming told a story of dispossession since 2003.
Palm trees need consistent care, watering, pruning, fertilizing. Rubai says when farmers left, the trees suffered.
So many people are forced to sell their land for very cheap. And oftentimes farmers have come to find themselves working on land that they used to own.
Iraq has also been getting hotter and drier. According to the UN, it's one of the most vulnerable countries on Earth when it comes to climate change. Kali Rubai says the current condition of Iraq's date palms tell that story.
There's a section of the southern part of Baghdad. If you drive through, you can see a lot of trees that look like they've been decapitated. And this is not an uncommon sight.
Making matters worse is Iraq's construction boom, especially in bigger cities like Baghdad. That means more farmers choosing to cut down palm trees to make way for building projects.
The farms have a problem. There is no water. There is no commercial income from this farm. So I cut the palm trees and I build buildings instead and get more profit.
This is Labib Kashif Al-Gitta. He and a couple of his friends came up with an idea to address the problem. They created a startup called Nakhla, Arabic for palm trees. And the concept is this. Homeowners with palm trees on their land can sign a contract with Nakhla to have the company take care of the trees. A lot of times, Al-Gitta says people just cut down the trees because they're too much work.
Palm trees for them is a very heavy project. They need to take care of it 4 times per year.
Al-Gitta says his company waters, prunes, fertilizes, and vaccinates palm trees. Yes, trees do need to get vaccinated against fungus, for example. Come harvest time, Nakhla either packages and hands over the dates to the tree owner or takes the product to market, depending on the type of contract. These types of services are not common in Iraq, but Al-Gitta says the company is growing. It's expanding its client base and recently signed a contract with the municipality of Baghdad to take care of the city's many palm trees.
Last year, in houses, we had 300 palm trees. Farms, we had 1,000 palm trees. And the street, we had 6,000.
The Iraqi government is also funding reforestation programs. But biologist Ayad Wajih Al-Shahbani says to truly bring back Iraq's palm trees, a lot more needs to be done. Private projects like Nakhla and others are good, he says, but they need more support from the government and international organizations. Kali Rubai from Purdue says a lot of Iraqis see the value in helping to save the country's iconic palm trees.
People are stubborn and they are not going to stop. They are finding different grassroots tactics to keep their trees alive and also to keep the date economy alive and maybe even grow it back.
She goes on to say that Iraqi date palms are incredibly resistant. They can cope with all kinds of environmental stress like storms, wind, and drought. They just need a little help to thrive. For the world, Shirin Jafari, Baghdad, Iraq.
Every year, going back more than 2 decades, people in Jerusalem stage their Pride March. This year, fears were running especially high. That's because members of Israel's new hardline conservative government have been speaking out against the march, and they are the ones responsible for the event's security. Today, thousands of people marched to promote the rights of LGBTQ people in Israel. Hundreds of counter-protesters showed up to greet them as well. Reporter Fuad Abu Ghosh is there. How did things play out at today's Pride March, Fuad?
It did play out very good today. Thousands of people managed to come to Jerusalem. Other marches took places in different cities as well. This is the main one in Jerusalem. I talked to people from different ethnic groups, different ages. I even saw people who are religious with the yarmulke wearing on their head. They also took part of this parade. I saw politicians who came also to remind the lefties in Israel that we are here and we can make a change.
So there were also threats against the marchers today. What were all those about?
Back in 2015, a far-right radical extremist attacked a teenager and killed her. He also managed to injure a few others. Since then, the tension been mounting, and because it's Jerusalem and because of society in Israel shifting toward the right, so there is a great threat toward this community. Yesterday, the Jerusalem police managed to capture three Jerusalem residents because they wrote on their social media some kind of a threats. The police is basically all over, on top of the roofs, snipers, helicopters. They took these threats seriously.
So Itamar Ben-Gvir, he is the new national security minister in charge of the event's safety. He's from the far-right Jewish Power Party in Israel. What did he say about those threats, if anything?
Actually, he did show up and he spoke as a politician. He said, my duty is to protect those people and also to protect the people who are marching and who are opposing this Pride parade. He actually, in the past, before he became a minister, he promised to prevent this march from taking place in Jerusalem. In fact, during his election campaign, he was promising that Jerusalem will not see any of the Pride parade anymore if he will be in power. But he's not strong enough to prevent the Pride parade from taking place. His speech was very limited.
Fouad, do you get the sense that LGBTQ people in Israel feel less safe under the new far-right government?
These days, yes, of course. There is a sense of a fear. Everyone I talk to, they keep mentioning dictatorship. We're losing our democracy in Israel. This is like becoming more and more obvious to those people. Yes, there is a great fear that they sense from these people.
So you're in Jerusalem. You've been speaking with some of the marchers. What were you hearing?
Here in Jerusalem, I heard different people. Some of the people that I met, Yoav, who came all the way from Haifa.
This is your first time here participating in this parade?
For me, it's first time.
How is the
feeling? At the beginning, he had some fear. He didn't feel comfortable. He didn't feel secure. But when he saw the mass people, he felt a little bit comfortable, and he basically felt good.
So, Fouad, Israel, as we know, has had many protests in recent months, mostly by those on the left opposing the government of Benjamin Netanyahu's plans to reform the courts, the judicial system. What is the connection between the Pride March and these anti-government protests?
Basically, freedom is the word. Some of the slogans and the banners that they see on a regular basis, I heard them and I saw them today. Basically said, if we let this government take our freedom from us, then we're going to lose. So we have to conduct our rights and protest against these people who are trying to take this right away from us. Also, I saw some politicians who are show up on a regular basis during these demonstrations, also at the Pride Parade, and they try to take advantage of this opportunity to tell the people they are willing to go back to form a government if you give us the power.
Fouad Abu Ghosh is a journalist based near Jerusalem. He's been covering Jerusalem's annual Pride March. Thanks so much for being with us, Fouad.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
If the status of the war in Sudan confuses you, that is understandable. The two warring sides have repeatedly called for and agreed to a ceasefire, then repeatedly broken that. We know this in part through their statements, but also thanks to geolocators. These are people who use video from social media to pinpoint exactly where the fighting is taking place, even the time of day. To learn more about how geolocating is providing a much clearer story of what's happening in Sudan, we reached out to Lou Osborne. She's a researcher at the Center for Information Resilience. We're catching her on the phone on a train to Belgium. First of all, the basics, Lou, for a non-techie, can you explain how you geolocate a video?
Yes, of course. So there is a lot of material
video photos which are posted online by people who are in Sudan right now. And what we do is we look at the video and we try basically to identify very peculiar points on the video that are very special, like, for instance, the color, the shape of the building, whether it has trees around it. And then we try to look at a satellite image, which you can find on Google Earth, for instance, and try to match what we see on the photo with the shape of the buildings and the landscape on Google Earth. I think what is difficult is to go from a video, for instance, which is showing 3D images, to then go and look at a flat map. That's the most difficult part. But once you know a little bit the city that you are looking at, it becomes easier and easier.
And presumably you can't rely on a single angle of an environment to verify. You have to, I imagine, corroborate from several different angles, correct?
We try to collect as many different type of footages as possible. And obviously some people also comment and give indication on where it could be. And so this is what we are using to pinpoint on the map where the footage are actually located.
Yeah, so you're probably looking for shadows a lot, right?
Yes, exactly. Shadows are actually a way to date photos, but it's also to see whether the footage are original or not.
So Lou, once you've confirmed a video is authentic, what have you been doing with them?
So what we are trying to do at CAR is to collect proof or indication of the impact of the conflict on population. Dead, people who are injured, people who are displaced. We look at how difficult it is for people to access basic services. So like hospitals, food, telecommunication, education. We are specifically looking at hospitals and the health sector because it's heavily targeted. And there are claims that hospitals are used by armed groups as bases.
Yeah, to that point, my understanding is that videos of violence of war can very easily violate a social media platform's community guidelines for graphic violence. I mean, it's not just a problem for you, geolocators, but also possible future prosecutions of war crimes. So how often are these videos taken down before you get a chance to collect them?
Social media platforms are getting better and better at removing violent content. So it's really a challenge for us. And what we do is when we collect those videos, we automatically and immediately archive them. Then they are preserved.
So once you start to analyze the story they're telling and you have a sense of a narrative, what does that feel like?
So I think from our perspective, it allows us to get a big picture of what's actually going on in a place that is now very difficult to access from the outside. I think at first, as a lot of people, I was mainly focused on Khartoum, the capital, and I had the sense that it was a little bit of a rift. There have been ongoing tension for some time, and we had that naive impression that it would not last a long time and it would be quite localized. And what I have seen, which I think is quite horrendous, is the fact that from day one, the conflict has been national. The conflict has been well prepared. And what we see is a heavily armed conflict. And we are just 1 month in. We see a huge amount of impact for population, you know, a lot of death. And we see that basically food is difficult to access. Medical attention is very difficult to access. There are blackouts in the country. By doing those investigations, trying to understand what's going on, make us feel confident that we can help people in the accountability process, basically.
Lou Osborne is a researcher who geolocates footage of the conflict in Sudan and analyzes them for the Center for Information Resilience. She was speaking with us from a train en route to Belgium. Lou, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
The Isle of Man sits at the center of the Irish Sea, Ireland to the west, the UK to the east. On a map, it all looks close together, but swimmer Adam Diver can tell you it is not. It is 32 long miles from the village of St. Bees in England to the seaweed-strewn beaches of the Isle of Man. The former army captain is the first person ever to swim the distance. It took him 55 hours, starting out Monday morning and finishing yesterday afternoon local time. Hey, his name is Diver. Still in his wetsuit on the beach, he described the achievement to ITV News.
I was pretty exhausted. The last few miles have been pretty horrific. But the last mile, when I could hear and I could see people. That was when it started to really hit home.
The last few miles may have been horrific, but the entire swim was a challenge.
I must have been stung 20 times off jellyfish. I got one in the face off a lion's mane jellyfish. It was pretty big. That was pretty awful.
Stung in the face by a jellyfish. Wow. It's 32 miles as the crow flies from the UK to the Isle of Man, but Diver estimates he actually swam 46 miles, taking the buffeting from currents into account. So often with incredible endurance feats like this one, we wonder, why? Why put yourself through this? For Diver, his goal was to raise awareness and funds for veterans' mental health. He's a trustee with a charity that helps homeless veterans rebuild their lives. Diver himself served tours in Afghanistan, Iraq, and Bosnia. The team that helped him complete his historic swim from England to the Isle of Man was made up also of veterans. Wildfires in the eastern Canadian province of Nova Scotia have forced the evacuation of more than 20,000 people. The blazes are inching near the capital, Halifax, and weather conditions in the Maritime province are not helping. Shalene Haynes is a wildland fire research scientist for Canada's Forest Service in Sault Ste. Marie, Ontario. I asked her how towns near Halifax are helping people who've evacuated because of the fires.
I think they're just trying to get people out of harm's way so that the firefighters on the ground can do what they need to do and, you know, put people up as best that they can in areas that are safe for them.
You know, many of us think of wildfires in Canada as something that happens in the western part of the country. Is it unusual that there are wildfires happening in Nova Scotia at all?
No, it's not unusual in the sense that there have been fires there in the past. It's just that, you know, more recently, the West has really been, you know, the epicenter of our fire issues. But it's not that we don't have fire there. It's just not as common.
And what started these fires in Nova Scotia?
I'm pretty sure that these are human-caused fires, as most of our spring fire season is predominantly human-caused because we don't have the lightning ignitions and the thunderstorms that go with that this time of year.
And based on what you know about these fires, what's fueling them? Why do they keep going?
Well, it's hot, it's dry out there, and it's windy, and there's the fuel that is dry enough to continue to allow these fires to burn.
Right, which would suggest that if rain doesn't come, that's just going to continue. There is a particular set of weather conditions that I know have you especially concerned. What are those? Tell us about them.
Within the fire environment, you know, we really pay attention to that lack of precipitation, which is happening right now, relative humidities that are quite dry, and then temperatures that are quite high. So typically, you know, above 30 degrees Celsius, below RH of 30%, and then you get the wind in there. So, you know, especially when you get higher wind levels, that those start to become quite concerning because any spot fires that occur will ignite quite easily and sustain flaming.
RH, that's relative humidity?
Yes.
There are some climatologists who are looking at the fires of Nova Scotia and seeing a worst-case scenario where it just kind of is sustainable for a while. Talk about that phenomenon.
They're sustainable until you can start to, the weather changes. They're, you know, depending upon the fire intensity, and I'm not on the ground to speak to what the fire intensity is at this point, but it does start to limit, you know, the tools and the toolbox that the fire managers have, because once the intensity becomes too high, it's harder to attack that front of the fire. And so they're limited to what they can do on the sides of the fire. So really, you know, they're looking for that rain to start to come to, you know, sort of calm things down, as well as the relative humidities to start to come back up so that the ground absorb some moisture, even if it's not from rain, and then those temperatures to come down as well as the reduced winds.
So in other words, a fire is drying out the air, and that in turn results in new weather patterns. If rain doesn't come, how bad could things get?
If we don't get the rain, then yeah, they'll hope at least that the temperatures start to decline and the relative humidity starts to come up. Because when we think about, you know, a fire moving, especially along the surface of a forest floor, you've got those, you know, that dried out dead material, you know, leaves and needles, and they can change really quickly. So, you know, even without having rain, you know, increased relative humidity, that fine material will start to absorb some moisture. So it makes it a little bit harder for that fire to progress. And so that starts to help firefighters as well. You know, it's not as big of an impact as if you actually get, you know, rain onto it, but it does make a difference there. And as well, you know, as the winds start to die down, that also helps to reduce that pushing of that fire and a reduction in that spread of that fire. So it allows them to do more in order to manage that fire.
Shalene Haynes is a wildland fire research scientist for Canada's Forest Service, speaking with us about the current wildfires in Nova Scotia. Shalene, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you. Take care.
We wrap today with some good old-fashioned Delta blues, straight from the heart of a place 100% not known for the Delta blues, Serbia. The artist's name is Sergei Green, also known as Sergei Gringo. And as Jerry Haddon reports, he is one of a kind.
I was skeptical, but when Green picks up his guitar, my doubts roll away like tumbleweeds. Green's sitting on his back porch. He lights up a smoke, riffs on his guitar, which he's named Jack. His dog, Jim, lies at his feet. This could be a scene straight out of the Mississippi Delta. But we're in Bačka Topola, a village in northern Serbia, a one-cafe town at the end of the bus line.
Marlin scribbles. Those are words and lines and rhymes like rivers ripple.
This is a Green original called Lost and Homeless. As to how a classically trained piano player from St. Petersburg, Russia, got hooked on the blues, well, Green says it's simple. He heard them. Once.
I feel that this music is like my pulse. That's the strange feeling, really magic feeling. And after that, I said to myself, Sergei, maybe blues, it's not only the music, maybe it's something more.
Maybe the word Green's searching for is obsession, because you'd kind of have to be obsessed to, say, write an entire blues opera, which is what Green did. He performed it once in Russia. The video was lost, he says, but the audio lives on. It's actually called Tumbleweed. It tells the tragic story of a broken-hearted man with nothing left but his six string and the lure of the train tracks stretching to the horizon.
Last train's like a blues man. Taking on in a one-way ride. This way from Harlem to Woodstock makes me feel alive.
Green's never been to Harlem or Woodstock or anywhere in the U.S., but in his head, he's traipsed across the country, his guitar on his back like a quiver. His English, he learned it listening to blues legends, Robert Johnson, Muddy Waters, Buddy Guy. On a recent night, he gigs in a tiny dive bar in Subotica, a nearby city. The crowd's small, but they're into it.
Very good music!
In my opinion, as a waiter, the music's fantastic. It didn't make me go to sleep.
Green says there's a small blues scene in Russian back home in St. Petersburg and Moscow, but he says singing the blues in Russian is like watching a film with voiceovers. Something essential is lost.
It's just like some mystical collaboration between sound of words and sound of guitar, for example. You know, it burns inside of you, like a little fire or maybe a great fire.
Lord, what will I see in the end?
Green says he left Russia last fall in search of a more peaceful place to let those creative fires burn. He says he's got no plans to hitch a ride back anytime soon. For The World, I'm Jerry Haddon, Bačka Topola, Serbia.
The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio at GBH in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you right back here tomorrow.